Hey folks, this is Simon Ward. Welcome to the High Performance Human Podcast. It's time for another episode where we are devoted to helping you achieve optimal human performance. Please check out my website, simonwardtriathloncoach.com, for all my latest blogs and send your questions to beth@thetriathloncoach.com. If you're not already a subscriber to the show, please go to simonward.podbean.com, where you can subscribe and make sure you don't miss any of our weekly episodes. Welcome back, folks, and welcome back, Mark Lathwaite and Steve Lumley. How you going? How you going, boys?
Good to be here. Good to be here, yes. And I like the fact we're in our little video booths in isolation, aren't we?
Well, today's the day. This will be coming out on the Wednesday. And so 2 days before, Boris will have delivered his message to us all, telling us what the new restrictions are. Things aren't looking so good for you, Mark, in the Northwest, are they?
Just as soon as he makes them up.
Yeah. My concern is that they're looking at locking down gyms and potential swimming pools. So I'm watching that very, very closely. Mm. But other than that, I mean, I don't like speaking to most people anyway, so isolation's all right with me.
Me too. You don't really go swimming anymore, do you, Steve? So
that's right. In February, twice.
Before they shut your pools.
Which year? I had to go to Malaysia to do it, though.
All right, listen, boys, thanks for coming back. Listeners, if you asked us a question, thank you very much. You're going to get a straight answer from us all today. So this is Grumpy Old Coaches number 4, where we are sticking to the questions that you have asked us. So we've got quite a lot. I've sent you them, boys. Are you ready?
We're ready.
Yeah.
All right. So I'm going to go through them as they appeared on the sheet of paper that I've sent you. So the first question, this was sent in by Beth Smith. She's my assistant. You each have to choose one of the other three to spend a year with on a deserted island. Who do you choose from? So you can either one of us. And why did you not choose the other one? So who wants to go first? Who wants to upset somebody first?
Are we talking about us three as coaches?
You have to select one of us to spend a year with and say why you haven't chosen the other one or why you've left the other one behind.
I have to select you or Steve to spend a year on a desert island.
Yes, so if you decide to spend it with Steve, you've got to tell me why you didn't select me.
I'd spend it with Steve, no. Hands down.
Yes!
Yeah, why?
I also spend it with Steve.
Why?
Why? Well, I just, you know...
Oh, come on, look.
I think you just irritate me. You see, what I can imagine is... I know you like your nutrition. I can imagine, like, crash landing a plane or something and I'd have, like, a curly-whirly left in my bag and you'd be going on in my ear about the sugar content and, you know, what about your insulin, eating your curly-whirly there? You know what I mean?
I'm afraid you're way off.
Whereas I think Steve would be quite a practical guy building a shelter and he'd be rubbing a squirrel and a coconut together to start a fire.
Two Boy Scouts.
You know what I mean? It's that kind of guy.
You'd be wrong about the curly-whirly because I'd be fighting you for it. Right, fair enough. Well, I won't take it too badly. Steve, who have you chosen to go with and who have you left behind?
Well, I'm going to have to go with Mark.
For what reason?
If he brings a blonde wig. And the main reason is that I do quite like a bit of peace and quiet occasionally.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
I've invited you. Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Yeah, anyway, we did have lots of other questions, but I'm going to answer those on my own.
This is the last Grumpy Old Couches podcast.
Okay, well, again, Steve, I'm not taking it too seriously. It's been a good 20. It's been a good... Somebody asked me the other day how long we've been friends, and I've said, well, not including today. So I would... Unfortunately, Steve, I'd have to go with Mark because the Birmingham accent, unfortunately, the West Midlands accent reminds me of my relatives, and I'm glad I didn't grow up with a West Midlands accent. So that would be the only reason.
I've never that popular in my entire life.
No, well, it's the only make believe, Mark. So don't get used to it.
It's not like you've got a big selection of very good quality, is it? You know.
I'm going to say it's, yeah.
Anyway, it's helped me shorten my Christmas card list this year. Neither of you are getting one. Right, okay, so Mark has chosen to go with Steve. Steve's going with Mark. I'm going with Mark. But yeah, there you go. All right. Now we're talking about other people, not any of us. What do you find are the most common bad habits triathletes have? What help and advice would you offer them to change these habits? So I think probably we all need to just select one here, and hopefully that'll give us three bad habits, and then how would we help them to change them? So, Steve, you go first.
Okay, being moderately serious, I think too much training ending up in the middle ground. So the easy stuff isn't easy enough and the hard stuff isn't hard enough and everything ends up in the middle.
What would you do to rectify that a little?
Well, get advice, really. Make sure you know some discipline in your training and to, you know what, whether you go on RPE, whether you go on pace, whether you go on power or whatever, know what's what for you and stick to it. So the bottom line is get a coach.
Okay, good one. Mark, what's your pet peeve over bad habits?
I suppose I'd expand a little bit on what Steve just said there, and just more of a generalisation. I just think that people just not following the training plan as it's intended, or just not doing it. You know, I think as coaches, I honestly believe that writing a training plan is the easiest thing in the world. And I think a lot of coaches are now putting too much attention on writing the plan and adding so much stuff in there to make it look like it's better value or whatever, make it really technical. It's like an art form. But the reality is people just don't do the sessions as intended. Half the time can't be asked to do the sessions at all. And there's underlying reasons there why they're not doing the sessions. You know, how do you get them to consistently do the sessions day in, day out? And that's not about writing the plan. That's about coaching that individual and their mental approach. So, yeah, just people just not doing the sessions as intended and not doing them enough.
Yeah, asking the right questions, why sessions aren't getting done, I think is something that a lot of coaches miss out on, you know, and understanding that maybe they didn't sleep very well or maybe they just don't like doing that sort of thing, but you never ask them.
And I do absolutely believe that coaches spend too much time thinking about writing the plan like that's the golden egg and then no one follows it, you know. Trying to get them to, you're better writing a really simple plan and making sure they do every single session as intended.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I agree with both of those, but in order to come up with a third one, it's this whole thing about gadgets. You know,
Mark might pile in on that one.
We'd have to have a minute here.
gadgets. You know, since we've been back in the pool, I've realised that these things haven't changed. Despite what we've spoken about in our previous podcasts, that people are still fiddling around with the gadget while the satellites move overhead to be in line with the end of the lane. Or, you know, I see them, I'm out riding or running on the towpath, and I see people, they're clearly in the middle of a run, they're sweating, but they've stopped and they're going through something on the phone, probably trying to select the next track. Or, you know, just over-reliance on gadgets. You know, I see questions that get 200 answers on Facebook pages about I'm wanting a new Garmin Fenix. Should I get the 5 or the 7, or should I do this? Just go out, get a Timex stopwatch and go out for a run.
I've got a new running power meter. What's the matter with me?
Yeah, I've got one here.
How long have you got?
It's in a box that's never been opened.
Yeah.
And if anyone I know has got one of those running power meters, I'd like them to explain to me in easy terms how it actually works. Because I see then questions about I've got my running FTP and it seems to be different to my cycling FTP and I don't understand why. Anyway, that's...
to paraphrase Blackadder, a running power meter is rather like a broken pencil.
Pointless.
Brilliant.
Brilliant. You know the thing, I'm not going to go off on a ramble here about gadgets because, you know, I could rant about this all day. But I do think that the gadgets, not just the gadgets, the data it produces is disconnecting people from the sports as well.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's disconnecting in the sense that they don't feel it, there's no perceived effort. And also, I'm seeing a correlation between more gadgets and more data and a lack of enjoyment. Enjoying the process of going out and just training for the sake of it and enjoying running and cycling. And because there's so many gadgets now that tell you that actually you did quite crap in that session. Data tells you that. Data's giving you reasons why not to enjoy it. And I do think people are coming very disconnected from it.
I hoped that the whole sort of lockdown period where people were just thankful that they could get out and go for a run or a bike ride might have corrected that and just that brought the enjoyment back. But it just shows how quickly people forget, don't they, and go back to their old habits. Mm. Right. Okay, then. Good answers, both. So the next question then for me and Cartwright. To pee on the bike, I presume he means while you're riding, because I'm not popping outside to pee on mine right now. It's raining. To pee on the bike or find a suitable gate or lay-by?
Ian Cartwright. Anybody know him?
No, not personally. So I'll start on this one then. So if I'm doing an Ironman and there's nobody around near me, because since I first started, they've got a lot hotter on this. And now if you get caught by a bike marshal or if a volunteer sees you and reports you, you can get disqualified. So the first race I did, Ironman Canada, going down Richter Pass, Steve, you'll remember that. A guy told me my water bottle was leaking until I said, it's not my water bottle, buddy.
No, it ain't.
But that's a nice 10K descent, so you've got plenty of time there. But if I'm doing an Ironman, definitely. I guess if it's a half Ironman, I don't find the need to pee if I'm doing a standard distance race normally once I've got started. And if I'm training, then, definitely I'll be...
Well, if you do it, I presume he means when you're racing.
Yes.
Not when you're training.
Yeah. So, yeah, but I have, during an Ironman also, I have got off and found a gate if there's been lots of people around. But even now, if you don't pee in the allotted portaloos, you can get disqualification as well. So got to be very careful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say, if we, just like Steve said, just confirming, we are talking about during a race, and would you pee on the bike during a race and not just in training? Because, if we're
racing.
Talking about training.
Racing.
Yeah, in training, 70% of the time, I'd definitely find a gate. If it's racing, then, it is a tricky one, because Ironman penalise you now. I don't think you're peeing on the bike. But, and I think you have to, there is an art to it, I think it's, checking there's no one behind you, finding a suitable downhill. It's not fast, so fast that you're going to lose control, but fast enough that you keep maintaining momentum. Getting your foot at the correct pedal position, the correct elastication in your shorts, pull up the shorts, pee under your thigh. And I do find that works very well. So I have to say, an Ironman, a penalty by admitting this, but yeah, I find a quiet spot if I can. And I'd try and do it when there's no motor referees around. But I'm also at that age where I probably need to do it in a sprint distance now, I've got to be honest. When I was younger, I could hold out for an Ironman. Now I'm at an age where, it could happen in a sprint distance race for me.
I always wondered why you came back weighing two kilos heavier than when you started. Steve, anything else to add on that?
No, on the bike. If there's somebody drafting you, save it till then.
Yeah.
Or if I have a suitable a bottle of water handy, maybe for ablutions.
For sure. Yeah. Okay. Well, on the next,
definitely not in training, though, especially in a group.
The next one's along similar lines. how to prevent the runs in long distance running?
That's a tricky one, isn't it? Because this is quite a serious question as well. You do tend to get a certain percentage of people who do suffer. You look like an evil villain holding that cat.
Blofeld.
Yeah.
We have ways of making it pee on the bike, Mr. Bond.
we're on to number two now, Steve.
Have we moved on?
There does seem to be a certain percentage of people, doesn't there, who actually genuinely suffer with stomach problems when they're out running. Mm. And you can go through all the usual stuff that, like, the fibre in the diet and drinking too much fluids and things like that, and the foods that they eat and fruits and whatever else, and things that could potentially give them the runs when they're out on a long run. But I'll be honest, I think there is a certain percentage of people who do just have the trots when they're out for a long run, and I've never found a proper solution for it. It does happen in Ironman for a lot of people, doesn't it, when they're just knackered, I think, when you're fatigued, that... reality is people are just so fatigued that everything's just giving way, isn't it? It's the end up on the run, not being able to stomach stuff and having to jump into portaloos and things like that. But yeah, I think from a nutrition side, Simon, what's the general advice you would give if people are suffering the trots when they're out?
Well, you talked about the fibre. I think that's if you cut out fibre for 36 hours, or most of it for 36 hours before you race, that does tend to sort of fix about 80 to 90% of the problems. Actually, when I did the podcast with the lady about the gut health recently, she talked about leaky gut. And when stress hormones are released, particularly, you know, in long distance races, particularly when you've been out there a long time, your whole body's under a lot of stress. And I think that's partly got to do with it. I also talked to one of my early podcasts with a gastroenterologist, and he talked about leaky gut. And he said in hot races, particularly if you're not acclimatized to racing in heat, that can have a big impact on what happens in your stomach. So there's a whole lot of stuff. Really, I think if you're just going out for a long distance run, I think in training, that's probably more to do with the food you're eating. In racing as well, there's the stress of racing, and also the race nerves that you get, because, you know, if you're going out for a long run with your mates, you don't wake up with a dodgy tummy, do you? But on race morning, you do. You seem to.
Yeah.
Steve?
Yeah, no, I think for normal, if you like training, I think sort of watching what you eat in terms of fibre, and also when, you know, if you are susceptible to it, then try and leave a decent amount of time, you know, 3 or 4 hours maybe. I used to get it in Ironman, the first sort of 5 or 6 I did, I always got it, until I actually stopped taking any solid food on the bike or the run. And whether it was fibre content or whether it was just, you know, the fact that it was sitting in the gut, I don't know, but going to sort of purely gels and liquids sort of has generally cleared that up. Although, as you say, Simon, in extreme heat, I've had further issues, but cutting out the solids was the main thing that helped.
You do a lot of long distance fell running, Mark. Do you get the same stomach issues in that you might do in an Ironman?
I don't get stomach issues at all. I seem to have an iron stomach, fortunately. But I do tend to, you know, I can just take whatever on Ironmans and long stuff, and it doesn't bother me. But I do find that with Ironman races, when people are saying, "Oh, I can't stomach gels," or "I'm feeling sick," or "I'm having the runs," I think there is that basic conversation that, well, it is just, there's a fatigue element there. So you'll tend to find that people won't get dodgy stomachs on the swim or the bike. They're getting it on the run because it's later in the race and they are knackered. And when you're knackered and stuff starts shutting down, that's what's going to happen. So if they go out on a 2 or 3 hour training run from home, they might not have a stomach problem. But then they're saying, "But I get it in Ironman." And, you know, there is that obvious thing there that, well, that's because you've been on your feet for 10 hours and, you know, when stuff starts shutting down, that's what happens. But it might not be running per se. It's just the fact you're knackered. So get fitter and, you know, it will get better.
It always interests me that the recommendation from the nutritionists that have done the research in the lab is, you know, 60 to 90 grams an hour. But when in a lab can you replicate the stress of a race? Yeah. Do you do a 60-minute swim beforehand? And then do you do a 2 or 3 hour run after you've done that 5 hours on the bike? Because that's when it happens, isn't it? Very rarely on the bike and very rarely in the early half of the race.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is this the bit where I can plug my nutritional supplement?
If you like it. Yeah.
No, I won't, but I will point people to Asker's website. There's a lot of stuff on there about gut issues and nutrition in general, which I think it's mysportscience.com.
Yeah, I've just written that down. I'll put a link to that on the show notes.
Which is an excellent resource.
Okay, well, talking of eating, if you eat too much food, you end up a little bit heavier than you should be. And our next questioner, Pete Heather, says, should races have weight classes instead of age groups? Right, and we've got a follow-up question to this one, Mark, because you put a response comment to this on a completely unrelated subject, but nevertheless quite funny. So firstly, should races have weight classes instead of age groups? Well, for all three of us, I think, we can probably go back with a history long enough in sport to a time when they did have a Clydesdale category, didn't they?
Clydesdale.
Otherwise known as the American group, is
it? Yeah. Well, was that? That wasn't just Ironman, though, was it? ITU used to have a Clydesdale, didn't they?
Oh.
Just American thing.
Okay. Yeah.
Was it Athena's and Clydesdale?
It was, yeah.
Something like that, yeah.
Yes.
There you go.
Yeah.
Oops.
Athena's and Clydesdale. So the question is then, should we have a weight category instead of age groups?
Yeah, can we have a marathon for slow people?
Well, we do. It's called an Ironman.
No.
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 It's this thing with you know, what you potentially see, though, is if, you know, because you said the Americans had this Clydesdale category, which was if you were over a certain weight. And I don't know, what is it based on? It must have been based on your height, wasn't it?
No, it was about, I think it was it no, like weight. 200 pounds, wasn't it?
Oh, you know what, Simon? I might be wrong, but I got a feeling John Lunt did one at Windsor.
Right. Probably because he'd seen it in America.
He might have done. If he lowers himself to listen to this, he might let us know.
John's been a guest on this show.
I've got a feeling that Windsor, at least one year, there might have been a Clydesdale and Athena division.
Okay. Probably. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So go on then, Mark. So
sorry, I'm going to say, but that could create all sorts of problems, couldn't it? If you've got a Clydesdale division, if you're over 200 pounds, you can go into the Clydesdale division. Do you know what I mean? You could look at that and think, oh, I eat a few pies, I could win me a weight category there. So if you're 180, it'd be encouraging you to put another 20 pound on to get into the Clydesdale. So rather than finishing the bottom 20% of the open category, you might get in the top 20% of the Clydesdale. Do you know, so you could be encouraging people to put weight on. You know what I mean? It's like the easy option. I put weight on to get into the Clydesdale. It's like aquabike, isn't it? You know what I mean?
Aquabike, yeah.
Well, it's not like aquabike at all. We're talking weight here.
It is. Do you know what I mean? I can't run, so I'll do an aquabike instead. And listen, you know what I mean? I'm better at swimming and biking than I am at running. I'll go for the easy option because I'll finish higher up in an aquabike than I will in a triathlon.
There might be a point when you can no longer run when you do an aquabike, and then we'll be having Grumpy Old Coach's
podcast
number 5.
There is, I regret this podcast, but I'm not at that point yet.
So I always wince when you watch lightweight rowing.
Well, they're cutting. Actually, they're stopping that now, aren't they? I think that, I can't remember who was telling me that they're gonna stop the lightweight rowing now.
It's
going to be a general open category.
Yeah, quite right. Causes so many problems.
Dan Plews does a lot with the rowers in New Zealand. Was saying that some like jockeys, those guys are like underweight nearly all of the time, and the long term problems it causes by sort of just training hard and forcing yourself to stay below your natural weight is probably not seen by most, but in the sport I think it's well documented. I just think if we keep having, we'll end up having so many classes that everybody will be on the podium, won't they, for this and that and the other. You know, we'll have a Yorkshire category soon, we'll have a Northern category, we'll have a category for people from where do you live, Mark?
Where am I?
Yeah, specifically.
Just between Wigan and Chorley.
Well, there is going to be a category for between Wigan and Chorley is next year.
Is there?
At Bolton, yeah. So if you enter that, you could win.
I'll tell you a funny story. This a friend of mine, he sadly passed away a few weeks ago, a guy called Paul Mason. But I remember a really funny story that he told me. And he moved up a category. He entered a trail running marathon. And he moved up to the Vet 50 category, and he was a fairly handy runner. And it was his first race as a Vet 50, and he was really excited because he was hoping he was going to win the Vet 50. And anyway, so he went and he ran, and he finished about, it was disappointing because he finished about third or fourth in the Vet 50 category. But what was even more funny is there was another guy called Paul Mason who finished ahead of him. So not only could he not win the Vet 50, he wasn't even the first Paul Mason Vet 50.
Even if they'd had a category for Paul Masons, he would have come second.
Yeah, I wouldn't even win the Paul Mason Bet 50 category.
Oh, well, Mark, you were pretty quick to post a response about, something about people carrying on wearing their GB age group vests to race in other events. And so somebody else said, I'd like to know why Mark has so much animosity towards athletes who race in their GB tri-suit.
I know this one as well. I know this one.
I've not got animosity. It was just a bit of a tongue-in-cheek joke. But sometimes when you turn up to a local race, you do think you're at the European Championships because everybody's got GB age group kit on. Now, if we had a category for just the people who are wearing GB age group triathlon tri-suits, I'd rather be in the other category because you have a much better chance of winning because there's hardly any of them who are not wearing GB age group tri-suits. But Do you know, I mean, obviously, yeah, I might be offending some people now, but
sure. Well, that was the idea. That was the idea of the podcast, to see how many people we could offend.
I have turned up at local race in a GBH group tri-suit many years ago, so I've got to put my hand up. A bit of a tongue-in-cheek humour.
So is this because you were just the butt of everybody's jokes for a bit then, and now you're trying to get your own back, hoping everyone's forgotten your performance?
Yeah, quite possibly. This is part of me rehab to get over that psychological abuse, yeah.
Steve, you said...
There's a lot of GBH group with tri-suits around there, isn't there?
Steve?
No, the short answer is it's because you look like a twat.
Say this, it is, Steve.
Well, that was what we said we were going to do.
We'll have to cut that out, Simon.
We're not cutting anything out. I don't think I've ever cut anything
there
out.
I don't know if we're mentioning names, but
we haven't done so far, but you can get started.
A British Triathlon Development Officer whose initials were Mark Barfield. He referred to these people as, you're a Sunday footballer. You're the triathlete equivalent of a Sunday footballer.
He's sadly, Mark's no longer with us as a development officer. Okay, moving on for that one. If you could travel back in time to the year when you started coaching and competing, what advice would you give the younger Steve Lumley or Mark Lathwaite, and the younger Steve Lumley, Mark Lathwaite coach, based on what you know now? So let's do, we've got two things then. From the first year of competition, what advice would you give to the younger version of you competing? And then what advice would you give to the coach who started when you started coaching? So let's do one each and do two loops. So the younger athlete first.
You're coming to me?
Yeah, go on, Mark, yeah.
As a younger athlete, I would say probably try a bit harder, because there's two sides to this coin. Because when I was young, sounds like a song, doesn't it? I never needed anyone. When I was young, I think when you're younger and you're a bit more talented, a bit more gifted, just because you are physiologically a bit more gifted when you're younger and you can do things you can't do when you're older, you are naturally better. And because if it comes a bit easier when you're younger, you therefore maybe don't feel you have to work as hard as you do when you get older, if that makes sense. So I wish I had the same commitment now, the same drive now that I had when I was younger. That said, I think that is only something that happens and something you think when you get older. So as you get older, because you look back and realise that you can't do the same things you used to when you were younger, you wish you could go back to your younger self and tell your younger self to be able to do those things more seriously.
And that's so the point,
what
that's
I'm trying
the point
to say in a roundabout way is, I think, yeah, I'd just leave it. I was happy doing what I was doing.
Right. I think I'm still with you. What about you, Steve? What would you tell your younger self, competing-wise?
As an athlete, I mean, I have very few regrets, to be honest. I might just sort of give me the nudge that you're still going to be doing this when you're 60, buddy. So, but no, I mean, I wouldn't do anything much different. I think it'd be nice to say, do more training or take it more seriously. But I think, you know, that's very easy to say, isn't it? I've done all right, really.
I see youngsters now who are very gifted, and it frustrates me that they don't take it more seriously. But I genuinely do believe that's an old person's mindset. That as you get older, that's why it frustrates you, because you're older. And yeah, you've got that kind of energy of the youth, if you like.
Yeah, and if they were taking it more seriously, they might not enjoy it as much.
Exactly.
And, you know, you've got to enjoy it. I have.
on that note there, I can remember people, you know Kez, I don't know if you know Kez Letnovicius, Mark, but Steve knows
him. Oh, yeah, I know him, yeah.
And everybody should know Kez.
The thing that I always admired about Kez was, whilst he competed hard, he did pretty well, didn't he? At one point, he qualified for Kona more times than anyone else in an age group. But Kez always seemed to have a fairly relaxed attitude to training. It was just like part of his life. He rode to work. He wouldn't have been one of those people that was super engaged in his Garmin or his stopwatch. And I think that's probably the reason why he's still, that sort of longevity in the sport. For me, it would have been to take a long-term view. I think I had this, what I see now in athletes that I sometimes whinge about is only thinking about the next race. And like Steve said, mentioned about the longevity there is if you try not to improve too quickly and take your time, I perhaps wouldn't have got injured as much as I did. I mean, there'd be a few other things there. Trying to do Dave Scott's training program from his book was a big mistake.
I did that one about 1988.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I've still got the book here beside me. So, yeah, a whole load of things. So now that we were coaches then, I presume you weren't coaching at the same time as you started triathlon, but think back to when you started coaching. What would you tell the earlier version of yourself, Steve?
I think I would say, emigrate to America and charge five times as much as you are at the moment.
You can still do that now.
Well, yeah, true. a bit easier when you're younger. Okay. I wouldn't want to go to America now anyway.
No. Okay, Mark?
Dunning-Kruger. It's got to be, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Dunning-Kruger graph.
Explain to people who don't know what that is, just what it is.
So basically, Dunning-Kruger, I mean, and put my hands up, absolutely explains me from when I first started coaching in my 20s, that I was so cocky that what I said was absolutely right and would argue any other views were wrong. And this is how it is. This is how you get faster. I'm absolutely right. And I think a lot of people are like that when they first get into coaching and they'll read a magazine or someone tells them that, this is how you should coach a training program. And there are no other kind of views. And then as you start getting a bit older, you realize that actually maybe that's not the only way. And, that doesn't work so well. And there's different ways of working it. And then it evolves further to the point where you suddenly start realizing that everything you thought was correct, you now think is wrong. And you seem to go around in circles and troughs. And so a lot of the stuff that I swore blind was absolutely true. Now I would strongly disagree with, and I think I got to the point now where I'm really not sure. I'm really not sure what's right and what's wrong, and I'm open to lots of different options. So, I think I'd tell myself that. Go and have a look at the Dunning-Kruger graph, but don't be too cocky in your first couple of years thinking you know it all.
I mean, you could apply Dunning-Kruger to all sorts of life situations, couldn't you? I think, but I'll put a link to that to that graph. I think for me, it would be ask more questions. That's one of the things that I've learned as I've gone along is just ask more questions of people, let them give you the answers rather than telling them. Sort of links in a bit with what you were saying there, Mark. It's just you know what you've got all the answers, so you just have to tell people, and that's what makes you a great coach. Of course it isn't. All right, good stuff there then. So next question, that was from Mike James, by the way. I think that's Mike the endurance physio, so you know him quite well, don't you, Mark? You must do anyway. He copies you in on all of his Twitter posts.
My Welsh compadre. Yes.
Yeah. Neil Holloway, he's a member of Leeds Bradford Tri Club, so I know Neil quite well. He says, race numbers, keep them or throw them away?
Ooh. Well, go on, Steve, I'll let you go first.
I'm going to bet, we haven't discussed it, but I'm going to bet we all did the same thing. We kept them for the first 5 or 6 years, maybe the first 10 Ironmen, put them on the wall, put them in the garage or whatever, and then forgot about it.
And discovered them last year when you were moving house.
Well, actually, last month I went to clear out my old house, which had been rented for years and years since I went to Malaysia, and they're all on the garage wall up to about 97.
Yeah. About you, Mark?
A slightly different approach, really. I think I started off with Steve. So when I was a kid, like when I was 17 years of age, my bedroom wall was wallpapered with my race numbers. When I started triathlon 31 years ago, I was 220 articles on the wall and all my race numbers, and I kept all my medals. And then very quickly, within a few years, I was just binning them and wasn't interested in medals or trophies or race numbers or anything like that. However, I've now gone on I've curved back in the opposite direction now. So I think now as I get older and you appreciate that longevity a little bit, that I don't look back and wish I kept them all, but I now appreciate things a little bit more. So if I do something in if I get a good result, certainly, so a couple of good results winning age groups in Ironman, and I mean, to be honest, this again is just a truncated way of me bringing that up. But I will, the medals and the trophies now, I'll keep them, and I want the photographs as well. And I think maybe I could have got kids as well as a little bit of that in there, but I'm getting a bit miserable of age. But you know, you start thinking, I'm going to want some of these memories. And I never thought that when I was in my 20s. But I do start thinking about it now and thinking, I'm going to keep just the special ones. So I did dig out some old medals that I've got from my age group wins, like national championship age group wins and European medals and stuff like that. And my dad gave me some medals. My dad's still around. He's in his 80s. And he was like silver medalist at the Northern Cross Country Championships and stuff. And they're made of silver. And those medals, I've got those, and they're just so precious.
Mm.
So I think, you know, there's a few things like that, which, I do now feel that I'm at that point where I'm cherishing things a little bit more and want to save some of those things.
I think I probably did what Steve did for a few years. I definitely had those race T-shirts, and then I started turfing them all out. I think I probably still got my numbers from my first Ironman in Canada. I've definitely got the numbers from significant races like going to Kona and doing the Norseman and Marathon des Sables and things like that. Again, I'm a bit like you, Mark. You know, as you get older, you sort of cherish those memories a bit more. You sort of find stuff, don't you? I've got up there behind me, I've got a whole box folder full of medals, and I was looking through them. And of course, when you look at them, it brings back memories, doesn't it? Not all of them, but you do bring back some of them. And that's probably just the nostalgia with getting older, I think.
Yeah,
I did actually saw, Tom Pidcock's just been signed up for Ineos, and he won the World Under-23s cyclocross again at the weekend. But he posted on Twitter a little, it must have been a cupboard under the stairs or something at his house, or, you know, like a little room where he kept all his kit. And he just posted a photograph, and the whole wall and the ceiling and everything was covered in numbers and medals hanging everywhere. And I'm sure he's got quite a few. And he said, oh, there's a lot of memories in here. So, you know, it's not just reserved for, it's not just a habit that's reserved for recreational athletes, is it?
No.
Okay, right. So, next question then. Paul Booth, multi-stage question. When you've got an interval session that says 8 or 10 or 12 times at max effort, should this be balls out from the start so that the performance drops off throughout the session, but you know you've given everything, or should it be an attempt to give an even pace through all of the efforts?
Well, I mean, for a start, it would depend on the size of the interval, wouldn't it? If someone saw me to do 20 minutes at max effort, I wouldn't go balls out for the first
time. You've got 8, 10 or 12 reps. I'd assume that they're probably going to be up to 3 or 4 minutes long.
12 times 20 minutes is a standard interval session for me. If you were doing like short intervals, like a couple of minutes, and I would always say to people, just, I think more for the mentality of completing it. And you could, I'll come back to this in a second about linking in the problems of data, but you probably want to pace them so you're doing them as hard as you possibly can whilst maintaining the highest power output throughout the interval and over each of the intervals. So what's the highest power you can sustain for 1 minute, repeating it 12 times and getting to the finish. And that's what I'd recommend to people. And I think this way you've got to be a little bit careful with going off too hard for the first minute. The reality is physiologically, that might not, that, you know, what I've just said about getting the highest possible power output for the full minute for each of the 12 by a minute, physiologically that might not be any better than just going eyeballs out for the first 20, 30 seconds and dying a death. But I think this is where you start bringing in the use of power and things like that. If someone was doing 12 by a minute and their power output was dropping for each of those minute reps because they'd gone too hard on the first one, my common experience is they would just pack in or they would just give up. So they're looking at it and going, oh, my power's down and it's dropping. So from a psychological standpoint, if nothing else for me, especially if they're training on a watt bike or Zwift and they've got a smart turbo or they're training to power, they should try and get them balanced because I think it just psychs people out otherwise. If you didn't have a power meter and you didn't have perceived effort, I don't really think it would matter. It would just be 12 by a minute really hard, wouldn't it?
Steve?
Yeah, I think it really comes down to what you actually mean by max effort. If you're talking about triathletes, very, very, very rarely are you doing anything at max effort. you know, I would suggest it's something like, if it's a VO2 kind of session, you know, that would be the 8 or 10 or 12 times a minute maybe. It can't possibly be at max effort, because max effort will last for, what, 8 seconds, 10 seconds? Lactate builds up and you're screwed. So it's got to be max effort for the X time period. You know, if it's a VO2, the idea is to keep, if it's a VO2 kind of effort, the idea is to keep your heart rate up as high as possible for as long as possible. If you're producing massive amounts of lactate in the first few seconds, you're going to have to stop, so you won't be able to do that. So even sort of 8 times a minute with, I don't know, 2 or 3 minutes rest, has to be a paced effort. You know, if you're in the pool, for example, and you're doing something to work on absolute max power, then that probably is the most common time that triathletes are going to do anything that is actually max effort. You know, it might be half a lap, you know, 12 and a half meters, maybe a whole lap. But very, very rarely do we do anything, or should we do anything, at max effort. I would suggest, if it's this kind of session where people say, oh, max effort, it's VO2 max. And even then, it has to be, to do it properly, keep your heart rate as high as possible for as long as possible. It has to be a paced. God, this is almost a serious answer, isn't it?
Right. So
it has to be a paced effort.
So to sum up what I think you're both saying is best sustainable pace or effort.
Over whatever.
Yeah. And like you say, Mark, that's where having a power meter comes in. But, you know, if you know your paces, if you know what your 3K pace is for running, or you know what your CSS is, and you can sort of take 2 or 3 seconds off that, and that'll give you probably your best pace, not your max pace, but your best sustainable pace.
Sorry, Simon, just to jump in. I think if it is a VO2 kind of effort where you're working harder than race pace, I would, as a coach, I wouldn't be worried about seeing a slight decline in pace or power output over that 8, 10 or 12 intervals or efforts. What you wouldn't want to see is a massive effort on the first one and then a stupid decline. Again, you know, if pace or power is dropping slightly, I think it's reasonable to assume the heart rate, which is actually the important thing, is probably going to be the same.
I mean, that's a whole other question as well, isn't it? It's about this whole using power versus heart rate, because power is just output. Heart rate really tells you what's happening to the body. And that is one of my bugbears, going back to that whole thing you talked about earlier, Mark, with response to programs and what people are doing, is I'm not sure often whether most triathletes or some coaches have really understand what they're trying to achieve physiologically. I really don't think a lot of athletes have any idea. You know, when you see them all smashing them down the pool doing threshold work, they're training hard and they feel fatigued afterwards, and they probably got out of breath and sweated. But physiologically, what are they really trying to achieve? And again, you know, ask most coaches about doing a VO2 max session, and it won't be a VO2 max session. It's more likely to be a threshold session.
Well, I mean, anyway. I'll just give you an example. And I mean, I do get hung up on this training intensity versus training output. So let's say this is an example of someone's doing 12 times a minute with a 3-minute recovery, and they're going to do those 1-minute intervals on the bike as hard as he possibly can. Okay. So if they go off on the first 1-minute interval and they ride at the highest power they think they can sustain for that full minute. So let's say they think they can hold 300 watts for that full minute. So they set off at 300 and they just about hold 300 for the full minute, and then they go into the recovery. Okay. Let's say by comparison, they go off at 500 watts for the first 15 seconds. And then what happens is there's a big spike in the power, then a horrific drop off over the last 40 seconds. They're completely failing. And the average power for the minute ends up lower than 300 watts. So even though they started high, they did 500 watts right at the start, and then there was a decline because they'd gone too hard, so they paced it really badly. That would probably feel physiologically much harder than pacing it correctly, but the power would be worse. So which one was actually physically harder? The one that generated better power because they paced it better, or the one that sent the heart rate the highest, filled the legs full of lactate, and felt like it was 11 out of 10 in terms of perceived effort because they paced it badly? So You know, there is, as far as I'm aware, there's no research to say that pacing it better actually produces more benefits than pacing it badly. And I would argue that pacing it badly would be physically harder and higher intensity on your body. But psychologically, I think most people would give in because the power number is dropping and they can't sustain it. So mentally, that's the issue with training to output and training to power. It mentally messes with your head.
There probably is something. I know Jack Daniels, where he has his different zones, levels for training, also shows grey areas. And it's almost like if you're in that grey area, you're training too hard for the level below and you're not training hard enough to the level above. So you're not really getting much out of it. And it's a bit like this when you train, when we talk about training easy, if you go up too close to the aerobic threshold or you're just over it for too long, you start to develop stress hormones, oxidative stress, which takes longer to recover from. So whilst that one session isn't that corrosive, if you do it too often, then it becomes corrosive. So there probably is evidence that if you're training a little bit too hard on those, and you know, it's probably not as good for you in the long run if you want consistency. But I think probably we're moving on to a different subject there, the physiology training, which we probably could make edition number 5.
Yeah.
So this was a question for me. Somebody said, I don't know if you saw, last year I was in, I can't even remember what the town, Shaftesbury, and I rode up the hill that appears in the Hovis advert. I'd always thought it was Haworth, actually, in Yorkshire, but it's in Shaftesbury Hill in the town. I think it's King.
I thought it was Haworth.
Yeah, King Hill. Anyway, it's a lot steeper than the one in Haworth. And one of my friends, Rob Griffiths, actually recorded me cycling up it. And there was quite a few people there going, go on, lads, go on. I'm glad it was dry. But somebody said, did I imagine myself as that little boy with the music going through my head? I mean, it did bring us back to time when I were delivering bread. Actually, I wasn't thinking about that at the time. What I was trying to do was to try, because somebody said, oh, it's really steep up there, and to try to keep going and not fall off, because there was quite a few people around shopping and I didn't want to make an ass of myself. So that was my main consideration.
The old Yellow Pages advert. You were right about that saddle, though. Yeah. Remember that one, the old Yellow Pages advert?
I do, yeah.
He wanted the racing bike and he kept saying, maybe next year. He's pedaling off Christmas morning. I was right about that.
Yeah, showing your eyes there. Yeah. Yellow Pages.
Yellow Pages. Good old Yellow Pages. What happened to them? Okay.
What sort of idiot hasn't got a copy of a book he wrote?
J.R. Hartley. I'll just have to have a look in here. Somebody said here, Mike Hall says, tips on transition, please. I've practiced and planned, but I'm still slow with my wetsuit in particular.
Body glide or baby all your ankles and wrists for a start, isn't it?
Yeah, and cut your wetsuit off.
Yeah. A lot of people don't like doing that these days.
Cut it off or down. Chop it down.
Yeah, 6 inches above the ankle.
Yeah.
Give it tight. And then send it back.
We used to do that years ago, didn't we? Cut the bottom like a couple of inches off the legs to make it. But no, people don't like obviously cutting the new product. They buy a new wetsuit. The last thing they're going to do is cut 2 inches off with a pair of scissors. But yeah. That's
Cut it at an angle, so lower at the front, higher at the back, so the actual hole is a bit bigger.
Yeah. I mean, you can, if you look at the way they're stitched, you would think, oh, if I cut through there, it'll unravel. But when I did the Ertelo race the first time, I don't think they had any purpose-made wetsuits available in this country. You could buy head ones in Sweden, but not in this country. So I got a blue 70 wetsuit and I cut it down into like a shorter, you know, like almost like a tri-suit. And it was fine. It didn't unravel at the seams at all. So you can cut them down. I mean, yeah. I'd have a good look first, and you can always tape up some of those seams. But if you remember, Steve, in the early days, some of the top swimmers that had them didn't like the feel of wetsuits on the forearms because they lost the feel. So they used to cut them off up here so you could feel the water on the forearm.
Yeah, no, cut down the wrists as well and don't wear a watch.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, as he actually had somebody video him.
Yeah.
Is it him? Yeah, Mike, yeah. As he had somebody actually video him what he's doing.
I think you go through that, having that routine. So as you come out of the water, generally if I'm doing a triathlon, when I come out of the water, I have the routine of knowing what I'm going to do. So I'll take my goggles off, but I leave my cap and goggles on my head to the end. and knowing where did I put my cord? Did I put it at the back of my hat? And is the flap over? Is the cord over the top or under the flap? So knowing what comes first, is it one, two, three, you know, and that, just working through that process and having it, that's what, as soon as you come out of the water, thinking through that process as you're running to your bike, and you should know where your bike is and have checked that in advance so you're not going to make any errors and just go, yeah, not just blindly coming out and throwing your arms around trying to find a flailing cord.
I mean, there is something else here is when you get race results where it gives you transition split, often it includes running part as well. And what I do see is, you know, you might be great at getting your wetsuit off and your helmet on, but how fast are you actually running when you come out of the water and when you're leaving transition with your bike? Because if you're walking, that is going to affect your transition time. So it's not just about the bit when you're next to your bike, is it? It's about the whole process. And a lot of the Ironman races have a timing mat as you come out of the water and then another one as you exit transition. So it includes getting to your bike and getting through the transition zone as well. But I mean, it's not dependent on physiological issues, is it? The transition,
yeah, it's just about technique and skill. Yeah.
And
the other thing is practice with, I know it sounds silly, but practice when you're wet as well.
Well, every time you go to do an open water swim and you're wearing a wetsuit, there's an opportunity to practice the first part of your transition, isn't there?
Or in some pools will allow it, you know.
Yeah.
But, practice. Because it is actually obviously a lot easier when you're wet, when the suit's wet. So.
Okay. Well, hopefully, Mike. But I think, you know, keep practicing. Practice under stress. You know, have competitions with your mates where there's two or three of you trying to do it at fast speed. Because that makes a difference as well, rather than just doing it on your own. And I think that's a good one as well, Steve, that you said. Get somebody to video you, see what you're actually doing. All right. Chris Hodgson has asked us how to, well, there is one for you, Mark. I'm right about that saddle, because Chris Hodgson says how to avoid or lessen lower back ache and pain and saddle soreness when in the aero position for longer distances.
Well, it's a tricky question. So as a former bike fitter, there's a few things you need to look at here. So I don't know what bike he's riding. I can't see his bike setup. So if your bike setup's completely wrong, well, there's your answer. That's why you're getting low back pain. Common things triathletes need to be aware of in lower back pain on the bike. So first of all, the bike you're riding, for a start, road bikes are generally not designed for tri bars. So people know this, but road bikes have much longer top tubes. So if you put a set of normal length tri bars on a road bike, and if presuming that road bike is the right frame for you, because you can ride a smaller frame to make it fit. But if you're riding a correctly sized frame, I'd say 8 times out of 10, you're going to be overreaching. Because tri bars are really designed to go on time trial bikes, which have shorter top tubes, so the reach isn't as far. And it's very simple, because in time trial bikes, you're resting your elbows on the handlebars. On a road bike, you're resting your hands. So for that reason, the reach is longer on a road bike. So if you have got a road bike and you want to put tri-bars on it, most people, to fit them right, the tri-bars don't extend much further than the end of the brake hoods. So if you've got a road bike with time trial bars on, that's probably your problem straight away. If it's a time trial bike and you're getting lower back pain, then there's various things you could look at. Look at the obvious one. Are you riding it enough? pull it out of the garage for race day and do 6 hours on it. Well, there's not really any surprises there. You're going to get a bad back. So you should be, if you're going to ride a time trial bike, you should be getting used to it at least when the weather's good few months, you know, before race day. You should be out on it at weekends. And I know we talked about this in the past, Simon, seeing people out on time trial bikes, riding on the hoods on the side for 4 hours. What's the point? You might as well go out on your road bike. So, and I appreciate you might be riding a bunch. So get used to riding it. And then the second thing is as well with a time trial bike is just getting a decent bike fit. So half the time, it's just down to the hip angle, isn't it? So if you're, you know, basically the hip angle is the distance between your stomach and your thigh, if you like, when your thigh's in the top position. If your hip angle is very small, then it can create a lot of stretch on your hamstrings and your back. So ways of increasing hip angle, obviously put your handlebars up a little bit. Shove the saddle forward a bit as well. So if the saddle's too far back, your worst case scenario is to saddle too far back and handlebars too far forward. And that creates a very, very closed hip angle. And that's generally what, you know, causes most people back problem. And then the other thing you would say as well is sort your back out. It goes back to the argument of fitting you to the bike or the bike to you. So the bike might be in the right position. You just might have crap back flexibility and mobility, and it's not the bike at all. Go and do some exercises, see a physio and sort your back out. You know, rather than coming and fitting the bike to someone who's got a dodgy back, sort out your dodgy back. That was everything. That was good, wasn't it? I was quite impressed with myself then, off the cuff.
It's like you used to be a bike fitter.
That's why Steve would spend time with me on a desert island, not you.
Well, that's awesome. Also sounds like you know what you're talking about, Mark. Steve, did you? Well, clearly, Steve, you would have nothing to add to that because Mark said everything.
Well, hold on there. I would add a couple of things.
Let me just think.
I don't disagree with anything, of course. Saddle soreness, I think choice of saddle can or is very individual. So people will rave about, oh, this saddle, that saddle. But you basically, it comes down to trial and error. Most decent shops, I'm sure Mark included, will offer you, you know, a trial saddle or test saddles. And it is very individual. So if you are happy that your bike position is good and that you are spending time on the bars and you're doing the training and the mobility and the S&C, and you're still getting saddle sore, then, you know, it might be worth sort of just experimenting with different saddle types and designs. And related to that is when you're training, spend as much as you can on good shorts with a good pad. Obviously, that's, you know, not so relevant when you're racing. But, you know, a really good pair of shorts, I think, is worth one of the very few things where you get what you pay for with triathlon gear anyway.
Can I just see, I don't mean this to come across wrong, Steve, but we keep seeing your monkey.
No, could be worse.
You keep seeing his cat.
Steady. That was my battery warning flashing up. Is the monkey gone?
His monkey's gone now. Yeah,
the monkey gone. Replaced by another monkey.
Disappeared.
Just don't let the pussy cat come back. I don't want to see that again. You pretty much answered it there, boys. Definitely. I like the one you said, Mark. It's just having a bike fit's not good enough. You actually need to have the mobility, not just, you know, you're in the clinic getting your bike fit and you might be sat in that position for 5 minutes. It's a whole different prospect sitting on the bike for 5 or 6 hours. The only other thing I would add is sometimes when people swim, particularly in wetsuits, the wetsuit tends to cause a bit of lumbar lordosis in the lower back, which then, if you've been in that position for sort of an hour, hour and a half, can then be exacerbated when you're on the bike. So it's not just down to mobility. You need a bit of core strength to maintain that good position. Yeah. You can see again when you watch people riding how much movement there is around the lower back there. So
a nugget of gold, really. You need to kind of stress that because we get so many people saying they get bad backs when they're swimming open water. And that buoyancy in the chest and the buoyancy in the legs creates, you said, this lumbar lordosis, which is basically that your stomach's hanging down and your back's arching inwards.
Yeah.
And they're getting bad backs during the swim. And then you get on the bike and you're producing completely the opposite position. Mm. You're going from your back arching inwards to completely arching forwards. And yeah, people getting hip pain and hamstring pain and for the first hour of the bike till they're adjusted. But yeah, that's a real big one.
I was going to say there is one other thing here that I noticed this summer. I was going to the lake and taking my bike with me and riding for a couple of hours afterwards. Most people don't. They do brick training and it's almost entirely reserved for bike to run. Mm. And it's very rare that I see people including in their sessions, probably logistically, but you know, there's no reason why you couldn't do this at your local lake and take your bike there, is I see them not really practicing getting on the bike and riding. And there's a whole host of things. You get tight adductors from wearing a wetsuit as well, probably because the way the pelvis position changes. And I think it's really important to sort of get the body used to that as well. So if you can, do some swim to bike brick sessions as well as the bike to run sessions. All right, let's move on then. So Chris Hodgson again says, if you've got no power meter on the bike, what's the best way to gauge your time effort in a race. Yawn. Go on, Matt.
I don't know. How would you do that?
Well, maybe we'd have to... Oh, the monkey's back.
Monkey's back.
We'd have to do what we always used to do before we had power meters. We'd have to use the old school methods of going by feel. I mean, how would that work out?
Yeah. Mr. Miyagi taught me that.
Wax on.
Take your watch off as well.
Yeah. On bike. Yeah.
Watch off.
It is true. Like I say, we've gone from... I've said this like many times with sports science, whether it's adding value or whether it's just adding data. And with power meters, I did feel like a little bit, sorry about that in the background. I did feel a little bit like it was just adding data for the sake of adding data. And there's useful ways of using power and stuff like that. And even heart rate, I find heart rate very unreliable in Ironman races, really high at the start. And it doesn't match my perceived effort. And ultimately, the only thing which is always going to be correct is if it feels easy, it's easy. And if it feels hard, it's hard. And I think that's, we've gone from adding some data to add value to suddenly losing basic feel for exercise and, losing the ability to pace ourselves based on what our internal physiology is telling us.
Mm. Yeah, but you've got to practice this, haven't you? You've got to go out and ride for several hours and see how your effort is based on feel compared to what you want it to do for the race day. And the only way to do that is to practice. And, by all means, use your power meter, but keep it covered up and come back and see how close you were. And the more you practice, the closer you'll get to what you want. But what's the worst that can happen if you try to do it by feel? You actually might have a better run because you've ridden a little easier.
And I said the other thing is, it's like it's some kind of magic number. So if I do a 20-minute test, you'll calculate my FTP, which is presumably what I can hold for an hour, although my FTP has never matched what I can hold for an hour, even from a 20-minute test. But are you just going to give me a number that I need to average for an Ironman? And that's miraculously going to be right from a 20-minute test. Mm. And then is the course hilly or is the course flat? How does that... then with the average power figure that I've calculated from my 20-minute turbo test. I mean, it's just, it might give you a random start figure, that roughly in a ballpark. But to think that, unless you're going to go and ride that same Ironman course 10 times before and practice it until you've nailed it, that's the only way you could ever get it right on. I just don't, I just think we're losing that. We're losing what is perhaps the most advanced feature, which is perceived effort. But people see that as old school. You're not technical enough. You need to move on now. We're using power. Well, the most advanced feature is perceived effort,
Not wrong with old school. Steve, anything to add?
Yeah, no. I think, there's a case for use. Let's say if you look at, an Ironman or a long distance bike leg, there is a good case for using a power meter for the initial effort, if you like, when... you're on the bike, you're reasonably fresh, you're all excited, there is lots of people around you. So it's a good tool for helping to keep discipline and keeping a lid on. So if you are, you have got a target to work to, it's basically to stop people going too hard.
Mm.
But, that's secondary to what it feels like. Experience will tell you whether you're going too hard or too easy or just right. So the power meter is a tool to like a shortcut to help give you that experience and give you that feel and give you that sort of self knowledge, but not a replacement for it.
I always used to say to people, if it feels just right, it's probably too hard.
Yeah,
yeah, because just right for a, if you were on a bike sport, even it felt just right, that would be fine. If all you're going to do when you get off is go and get your medal and have a cup of tea, but you've got to go and run 26 miles or 13 miles. So if it feels just right for the bike there, you've not considered the run part. So it actually needs to feel easier.
Especially really. At the start, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the really good example is, the Tour de France recently, Pogacar, he rode the last time trial without anything, didn't he?
Mm.
He did.
I don't think he even had a watch.
No, but he's there's a good podcast with his coach where he's saying, he wrecked that course several times, and he number one, he knows how much he can suffer. Number two, he wanted to put Roglic under some pressure by smashing the first part, And number three, it just practice.
Yeah.
Knew what he could hold. And number four, what's the worst that could happen? They're probably not going to overtake me to come second. And I'm either going to win or stay where I am. So give it a go. That's the sort of beauty of being 21, isn't it? And okay. So somebody asked, have you not yet realized, Mark, that saying all righty makes you sound like a dick? But Gareth, unfortunately for you, that wasn't Mark's words. Those were mine. And I know it makes me sound like a dick and I don't care. So, but thanks for pointing it out anyway. regarding your podcast photo for the Grumpy Shows, Mark. Chris Farrimond would like to know who's the hot blonde. So that must be your sister, is it? Marie Laithwaite?
I was trying to look like Magnum PI.
Huh? With blonde hair?
You failed, mate.
Couldn't find a dark wig.
You have failed on that one.
I don't remember him being blonde.
A mustache and a blonde wig.
Me neither. But anyway, well, I think perhaps we need to see if Chris Farriman's swiping right on that one or left.
There is a really
bring it to the desert island anyway.
We'll have to get this for the next podcast. There's a really famous episode, an old episode of Magnum PI, where he did Iron Man Kona.
Yeah, he turns round, doesn't he, at the end of the
bike leg, because he solves the case in the middle of the bike leg and turns round to go back and apprehend the criminal.
What was it?
And he's happy because he's got his helicopter company on the back of his T-shirt, and he gets all the publicity.
That's right. Yeah.
Right. We'll look for that.
Stood on the beach with his goggles around his neck, and I was trying to replicate that picture, but I couldn't. I didn't find a black wig, so I used a blonde wig instead.
Was
so
that
for the podcast picture?
Was that a real life? Who won it?
Kind of. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Well, we'll look for that one. So, Steve Rostron says
the question there. Is that why did he just happen to have a blonde wig lying to hand?
Well, so your next question, Si. Next question.
Yeah. No, I think we haven't finished on this one, Mark. Why did you have a blonde wig lying around?
It was the kids. It's for the kids.
So you've got cross-dressing children?
I think it was one of the Frozen characters. I think it was Anna from Frozen. Yeah. So.
You're digging now, aren't you?
I am. Yeah. Move on.
Steve Rostron says, how do I find my true athletic potential? What's the path?
Ooh,
Steve-O.
It doesn't say how old he is. So do you know? Does anybody know him? Do we know how old Steve is?
No.
I think the honest answer to that is I've got no idea. Get out and try.
Yeah. I'd say you've got to get out there and do it consistently. Build that solid aerobic base. Do it consistently. Make sure you enjoy it, because that will mean that you do it consistently. Focus on longevity. And as Si's pointed out several times, just keep going till you're 75, 80, because you're guaranteed a podium slot at Kona or one of the Ironman races.
Me and Steve are going to be the flag bearers for that one, Mark, because we're going to show you whether it's actually possible, and then you can decide whether to retire at 65 or not.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would say this is probably one of the bits of advice that I would have given my younger athletic self as well, is not to get overly focused on training being everything about achieving your athletic potential. I still think there's way too much focus, again, from coaches and definitely from athletes. If I just do more training, if I just train harder, then I'll be the fastest I can be. And you know, you see it, that the obvious mistake is getting up early to do a swim session and cutting back on sleep. You know, I don't see for 1 minute how cutting back on sleep to do more training is actually going to lead to anything better. So I'd say that true athletic potential doesn't just come through training, it comes through maximizing all the other things as well. So look at whether you can improve your diet, the quality of your nutrition, notwithstanding the occasional curly whirly, sleep as well, and life stresses. So that there's lots of stuff to be considered there. But true athletic potential, again, I know people who've chased that and they've stopped enjoying life in pursuit of faster times. And I'm not sure if that's a good sort of like victory either.
Mm. Balance.
Balance. Right. Bo Smith. Bo, is he, do you know him, Steve, or?
Nope.
I've got a feeling Bo used to be based in Leeds here at the university, actually. Do you know him, Mark?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Is he tall lad with blonde, fairish hair?
Yeah, he was on the North West Regional Academy.
Right. Did you train in Leeds for a bit?
Did he train at Leeds?
Yeah. Was he not at university here?
I'm pretty sure he was.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was, wasn't he? Yeah, yeah. But he still seems local. He does local races and some of the events that we organise and stuff.
Okay. So, yeah. He said, who's the most overrated ego in triathlon coaching?
He has just started coaching, you know. He's coaching clients.
Hmm. Well, so who's the most... Who's the most overrated ego? So,
well, look, Steve said he wanted to spend time with me on the island. So it's, I mean, I'm not in for that. In the running for that, am I?
What are you saying? Oh, is it? Oh, hold on a minute. Am I missing something here? Is this a question aimed at me? Is it?
The monkey's come back. Steve's disappeared. The monkey's back. He's getting out of it.
Well, let's discounting the three of us then. Who is there? Are there any overrated coaching egos in?
This is a BS question.
Well, I don't. I'm going to go back to Dunning-Kruger, and I think I would say every coach, me included, at some point in their coaching career, has had their ego's been overinflated. And they've been so cocksure of who they are and what they know and telling everybody else. And then as you move along that path, I think, you know, it changes a lot. So I put my own hand up for that one 15 years ago. I think you'll know from how difficult it is with coaches in particular. If you're running a coaching course, like a big triathlon coaching course, one of the hardest things you can do is have 12 coaches in a room together. It's 12 people who all want to tell each other how much they know sometimes.
It's difficult enough having three coaches on a podcast.
I think that's a trait of coaching, you know, because you can be very confident in what you know and think that you're always right. So I think everybody's at time to time can have a little bit of that.
You said it's a BS question, Steve, and you're absolutely right, because the person who asked it has got the initials BS.
Well, I think we need to look no further.
I'm with you, but
I think there's
other BSs in the coaching world.
there's a lot of BS. I was reading about a coach. He's a coach amongst other things, who was described as the alpha male's alpha male. I won't name names, but Bo can go and look that up.
The alpha male's alpha male.
The alpha male's alpha male.
Interesting. That's a great tagline for your website, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right, we'll talk about it on off air. Right then, I'm conscious of the time here, chaps. So a few more questions before we get onto the Lindsay Nuttall section. What to do and not do in winter training if you're put... Oh, right. What to do and what not to do in winter training. That's a whole podcast in itself, isn't it?
I can put it in three lines.
Go on then.
I'll do it in two.
I'll do it in one. No, that's impossible, bearing in mind what you two have said earlier. I'll do it in 10. Mark, do it in three.
I think in winter training, first of all, it's that foundation, and foundation is individual for everyone. What you need to do. It might be strength and mobility work, for example. That's what your most important thing might be. It might be aerobic base. So work out what your foundation thing is that you need to do in the off season. Number two is that you need to enjoy it, because I think mix your training up and make sure you enjoy it, you know, because if you can't enjoy it at this time of year and just go out for a bike ride for the sake of enjoying it or for a run for the sake of enjoying it, I think all that data and focus wears people down mentally more than they think. So now is the time to do what you enjoy. I didn't have a third one, so I actually did it in two.
Steve, are your two any different to Mark's two?
I'd agree with that. I might say work on your weaknesses.
I said that.
And if you've been at it, you know, if you've been doing it a long time, maybe just try and find something new, something slightly different to do. Or if we're doing things.
That was pretty much what I said, Steve.
Yeah, well, you know, you're a genius.
You know, for me, it's about consistency. I would say if you can just make sure that you do nothing to compromise the planned sessions. So if that means avoiding those epic rides with your mates, do it, unless you plan to do the epic ride and you're having a couple of days off afterwards. But you know, if you've got a session, if you've got a whole week's worth of sessions planned, just make sure that you do nothing to get in the way of that. And if you do keep doing that, it probably means your planning needs looking at. But trying to string together sessions can't be underrated, even if they're all moderate to easy sessions. I think that's better than doing the occasional super hard one.
Yeah.
Go on,
the consistency thing you're talking about as well. I do think the COVID, I mean, there's a lot of mental health stuff doing the rounds on social media at the moment. Mm. And I do honestly think the COVID stuff is affecting more people than we actually realise. And it's affecting people who don't realise it's affecting them in more ways than one. People seem a bit more angry and edgy and all sorts of things. And I think motivation is very tricky. And to train, like you just said, training consistently, that's the, if you're going to pull one thing out of success, it's training consistently, isn't it? Mm. Consistency of training, week in, week out, year in, year out. We've always said that's probably the key thing. And what stops people training consistently quite a lot of the time is they just can't be arsed. They're not motivated to do it. And I think if they can solve that, that enjoyment factor of doing something, they've got to enjoy the process. That enjoyment and then what comes with that motivation, without that, consistency is you forcing yourself to do stuff all the time because it's on the plan. And that can only go on for so long before they just had enough.
Right. Well, okay. So some good answers there, and that's sort of, you know, we're not making fun of that. That's serious. But then, sort of adding on to that a little bit, then Jason Heaton's asked, if you put in a 2 week isolation. So let's say you've come back from a holiday, for instance, abroad, and you're not ill, what can you do to maintain fitness? So, I mean, I'm assuming.
I know. Cycle to Durham.
Cycle to Durham, but to get your eyes tested.
Get your eyes tested. Cycle back.
Well, you could get on a train from Scotland to London, mix with a few people and... Oh, no, sorry. We've said if you're in isolation. So, well, the easiest one is to pedal your indoor trainer a little bit. Yeah, because you don't have to go out of the house for that. If you're lucky enough to have a treadmill, then I'd be on the treadmill. You can use band exercises and for swimming. And I would be doing more mobility and strength training, and you can use body weight stuff for strength training. And you know what I'd be doing? I'd probably spend a little bit more time learning how to cook a bit better and improving the quality of my cooking and my food, and maybe getting a bit more sleep.
I'd be learning to skip like Rocky.
Yeah.
In fact, I know a couple of people have done that.
Okay. So, Mark?
I think it's also like just do the planning stuff as well, you know, like in terms of people not servicing the bikes for winter and then what races do you want to do next year? And have you thought about your training plan over the winter and how you're going to do it and do a bit of research on it and come up with a plan and stuff? And sometimes you're so kind of involved in the process of training, you don't take a step back and go, right, what exactly am I trying to do for the next 8 weeks? And, you know, if they're not going to coach, and for the time period after that. So just take a step back and just plan stuff. So when you do come out of isolation, you're ready to go.
I mean, we're talking 2 weeks here, not 8 weeks. So, you know, it's not that long. And, you know, if you just have a maintenance load during that time, I mean, as long as if you've got some area of garden, there's an awful lot you can do with shuttle runs if you want to keep your running fitness up if you don't have a treadmill.
Or even stairs, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, right. So we're on to the Lindsay Nuttall section, and I've called it the Lindsay Nuttall section, Mark. She answered your Facebook page request for questions. So Lindsay, I think, posted 5 questions. So that's most people just stuck to one question, but not Lindsay. Lindsay's gone all in. So this is a special shout out to Lindsay. So she says, what's the top thing you see athletes do in training and racing that makes you cringe as a coach? So let's just have one each. Start with you, Steve.
We're starting with training or racing or both of them?
Either. We haven't got enough time to do both. One. So top thing. You do one from racing, Steve. Top thing that you see that makes you cringe.
I don't know, cringe, but it always amuses me a little bit when you see people with I think we've mentioned it before, you know, 5 grand a bike on, under them, and they're sat up on the hoods, pedaling the way around an Ironman with an aero helmet on.
Yeah, well, that was mine. Having aero bars and not using them, for sure. What about you, Mark?
Racing, I would say, people trying to jump on the bike and they've never practiced putting the feet in the shoes, and getting 10 yards from the mount line and having to get off and pick up one shoe that's on the floor now, and then take the other shoe out the pedal and put both shoes on and then get back on the bike. So that is hysterical, because if Sim Brownlee do it in the ITU race, and they thought, I'll have a go this weekend. And then the other thing, aero helmets with a point pointing upwards at the sky, that really does my nutting. You know, when they're on the tri-bars and the point of the aero helmet's pointing upwards, they've got it too far forward. And it's actually less aerodynamic than wearing a normal helmet, that proper, like, I want to push them off.
I've got a story for you there, actually, that also goes back to the power meter in a race. Faris Al-Sultan, when we were in Kona, the bike mechanics for Cannondale were right next to our booth. And so I was asking him about his bike. And I said, and I looked at the power meter, the SRM power meter was taped over, so you couldn't see what was on the face. And I said, what's the point in having that there if he's not looking at it? He said, well, it's there because SRM are sponsoring him and they want to see the data. But actually, he doesn't use it because, A, he rides to feel, and B, because if he does look at it every time he dips his head forward, the point sticks up and it affects his aerodynamics. And then I remember being at the press conference and somebody said to him, so Faris, what tactics have you got for chasing Norman? He said, I go as hard as I can to keep up with him. If he's too fast, I will lose. And that's it. You know, so if I can keep up, I will. And if I can't, I won't. But I'm not going to be gauged by a power meter telling me, oh, no, I must slow down now. So then the next question on from that says, do you find it difficult seeing people you don't coach when you're at the swimming pool, when you're out running, when you're out riding your bike, or when you're driving and seeing people riding? And do you find it difficult not to go over and try to help them by correcting it? So if you see people swimming badly, would you go and would you give them some tips to correct it, or would you just shake your head and walk on?
If I'm swimming in the pool and there's a guy in the lane next to me swimming badly, would I correct him? Mm. I'd never get any swimming done if that was the case. I mean, you'd never get anything done, would you? No, generally not. I mean, we do have kind of, from the shop, we have like social runs and stuff on a Saturday morning, and people go out. And I'll always, if I'm out on bike ride on a Sunday ride with a club and groups that go out on a Sunday and whatever else, I'll always chat to people and tell them if they ask, and I'll give them advice on what they should be doing and what they shouldn't be doing. Quite happy to talk to people anytime and give them free advice. But I wouldn't, like, if I saw someone going in the opposite direction and his aero helmet is pointing up, as much as it irritates me, I wouldn't turn around and ride after him. You know? So no, I wouldn't stop people in the street. That would be a bit weird.
But do you ever find yourself, like, if you're driving and you see somebody running and thinking, why are they bothering running? They'd be better off walking.
I've got to be honest, a number of people that have come past me and I've looked at them and thought, how can they even run with that running style? Look at the state of them, and then you realise they've just come past you. I just keep my mouth shut now.
What about you, Steve-O?
No, I wouldn't give unsolicited advice to anybody I didn't know. The only time I have is sometimes in the gym, especially when you see somebody doing something that's just dangerous to themselves or others, I've had a word. Mm. You know, people squatting without stops on the bars and stuff like that. But no, I don't.
When I was with Yorkshire Cricket Club, we used to go to the David Lloyd in Leeds, and I used to teach all the lads how to do the lifts properly. And one day there was a guy doing some bent over rowing, kneeling on the bench, but he was kneeling on the wrong knee and he was pulling from the wrong side, and they're all going, Wardy, look, he's doing that wrong. Go and tell him. I'm not telling him, but he's doing it wrong. He shouldn't be doing it like that. So,
could be a gym instructor in there, shouldn't there? That's the bottom line.
But one of my mates did go over to tell a bloke, and he said, my dad told me how to do it this way, so that's why I'm doing it. He said, but I can show you a better way. My dad showed me. So he says, well, it's some sort of family heirloom, this exercise, and it's handed down from your dad to you, to your son. But people don't want to be told either, do they? So,
I've been told by giving instructions in a race by someone. I've had that.
Yeah.
Am I allowed to swear on this podcast?
You can swear. We might cut it out. Okay. Just don't use the F word.
Oh, that was that problem. That I'll have to just.
If it's a quotation, it's probably okay.
Yeah, it was a quotation.
Well, what did you say?
About quite a few years back now, doing a crit race at Preston Arena, and they have a little like a cycling circuit, a closed circuit race, and these crit races, they're like just so rapid, so fast. And they're going into the bends like at incredible speeds. For bike handling, it's brilliant because you just got to go with the flow of the bunch. And I always remember one time we turned up and the lad that had gone with, mate Richard, and we were on the line. I turned around to him and said, listen, Rich, be careful, because when they say go, they'll go. And if you're not on the back, you'll get dropped. And as I turned and looked back, they'd gone. And we'd both been dropped. And we just had to cycle around easy until we got lapped and then get back in the bunch because no one would get back on. But anyway, the next year, the following week, we're in the race. And if you're scared of cornering, when you're in a crit race or a road race or a chain gang, what's good about it is if there's 20 people in front of you and they all lean into a bend and get round it without falling off, you've got the same tyres on, so why are you going to fall off? So it gives you confidence and you've got no choice. You've got to go into it because otherwise you're going to hit the person to the left or the right. So we're going into this corner and we had the wind behind and we must have been doing like 35 mile an hour. And they're going into this really tight bend. And they all just go flying around this bend. And just because I'm coming into this bend, I start twitching a bit, thinking, well, look, I'm not going to get around this bend. I'm going to slide off. And subconsciously, my fingers just touch my brake levers. And you know, it makes that noise when you touch on carbon rims. And there was a kid to my left, and he must have been about 12 years of age. And he went, get off your f***ing brakes! And I panicked and I went, I'm sorry, sorry. He's only about, I must have been about 40. I'm sorry, sorry. And I thought, you little he's about 12 years of age, this lad.
Yeah, but he was right though.
He was right. I've had, I always find it quite amusing when people try and give me advice at races.
Yeah. And they give what?
So it's quite amusing sometimes when people try and give me advice. Mostly people wearing GBH group tracksuits.
We've been down this rabbit hole.
Right, but listen, we've got less than 15 minutes. We've got 10 minutes and we've still got four of Lindsay's questions, and seeing as she made the effort to put them in, I don't want to cut her limelight short by Lindsay now wants to know, what's third question, what's the biggest mistake you've ever made in a race? So, Mark, yours was giving Steve some advice while you were wearing that GBH group kit. Is that right?
Yeah. Never forget that swift left hook. I'll never get over that.
What's the biggest mistake you've ever made in a race? A quick one.
I can remember. Let me think. Yes, Ironman Wales. Not last year, year before, 2018, Ironman Wales. I decided 3 days before the race that rather than take gels or bars, I had some gels. I'd seen someone with little mini Mars bars on the handlebars, and I thought, do you know what? I get sick of eating bars. Why don't I get some little bounties? Bounties are good, aren't they? They're proper good bounties. Some little bounties and some little Mars bars, and I'll take those with me, and I worked out how many grams of sugar were in and all that stuff. And I've never, ever in my life had mini Mars bars or bounties on a bike ride or any race. But 2 days, 3 days before Ironman Wales, decided that was a good strategy. And that's what I did on the bike. And I was throwing them up by the end of the bike. And I look back and just think, why on earth, after 9 months of training for it, would you even think about doing that? But, you know, it was a bounty, so you can understand.
Steve, quick one from you.
Well, I've entered a few I shouldn't have, but... Actually, in a race, do you remember the, that's where we first met, Si, actually, all those years ago, Ironbridge.
Yes.
Ironbridge tried. Do you remember 1 or 2 years it was televised?
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of those years I came into T2 and didn't just forget exactly where my bike was, my run shoes were. Complete blank. I hadn't got a clue, not even the right row. I eventually had to walk up and down every bike rack in transition to find it. I had the wrong side, everything completely gone. And it coincided with the TV crew being in there who filmed the entire lot. Okay. And another one on the TV theme.
Hold on. We haven't got time.
I just remembered this one. I did an adventure race, but it was a Scottish coast to coast in the 90s, and it was a 3-day race, and that was televised as well. And the last day was a kayak down the River Dee into Aberdeen, mm-hmm. and that's where it finished. And again, the one time you had a race assistant that went ahead of you to set everything up, and bless him, the guy that was helping me out was our old swim coach at the time, and he got me kayak down onto the shingle beach where we launched from. So I jumped off my bike, ran down this bank, got me kayak suit gear on and everything, jumped in the canoe, only to realise it was the wrong way around. So I was facing backwards. So for a moment I had to think, do I push off in front of the TV crew that were filming again and jump out downstream around the corner, or do I get own up and get out now? So I had to get out on TV, turn the boat round, get back in it and push off.
I remember seeing in one of the, it might have been 220 magazine or Triathlete, how somebody had taped all of their gels to the top bar, and I thought that looks really cool. And I'd got this beautiful brand new Basso triathlon bike, lovely paint. If you remember, Basso had some really nice paint jobs. So I diligently stuck about 10 gels all the way down the front of the top tube, and I was going to tear one off. And I think it was at Ironbridge, actually, Steve. And when you got out from you went down out the village to the bottom, and then you ended up on the bypass. I remember riding down there and getting my first gel and pulling it off. And the idea was that I was going to pull it off and take the top off as well, and then I'd be left with this thing. Well, the first thing that happened was that as I pulled it off, it lifted a short section of paint off the top tube right down to the bare metal. And the second thing was that as it pulled the tab out, the gel went all over my face and all over my hands and all over my legs. I didn't get any gel stuff in. So I went to get the second one, and of course it took another lot of paint off. So by the time I had no gels, and there was a whole strip of paint about 3/4 of the way down the top tube, from just probably in front of the saddle right down to the stem, was just completely pulled off all the paint. I needed a complete respray, and I completely bonked because I had no fuel on the race. So that was an expensive lesson.
Should have had bounties.
Yeah. Three more questions. So these require quick answers. What's the biggest change in mindset or behaviour you've seen in athletes since COVID?
Me?
Yeah, either one of you. Just a quick one.
Putting it bluntly, they can't be arsed.
Right.
They're losing motivation. And it's really hard to keep them motivated.
Steve?
Yeah, I've seen some like that. And I've also seen people sort of basically the other way around, that they've embraced the training rather than the racing.
Okay, I've got embracing one as well. I was going to say there's a lot more people who've embraced indoor training, particularly Zwift, I think. Okay, we've all been injured. What have you learned from it? One thing.
Be patient.
When you get a small niggle, don't just keep going and think it's going to disappear. Solve it before it stops your training for the next 6 months.
Yeah, what I've learned is if you haven't fallen off your bike and broken your collarbone, or you haven't twisted your ankle, most injuries that you get, chronic injuries in triathlon, are usually as a weakness somewhere else. So it's not the injury. It's not, you know, if you've got bad calf, you don't need to be straightening your calves up per se. It's maybe coming from your back or your shoulder. So take the time to find out what's the real cause. Right, one last one then to finish off with. This is an either-or question. Would you rather never be able to coach again or never be able to race again?
It's a good question.
Well, I'll start off. I thought about this one, and I'm, to be honest, if you give me the opportunity of a race like Patagonia Man or doing Norseman again, I'd be quite happy. But if I could never race again, I wouldn't be that bothered. I enjoy the process and the training with my mates. I think at this stage in my life, I wouldn't be bothered about not being able to race again. I'd be more bothered about not being able to coach again. Steve, Mark?
Yeah, a tricky one. I think I completely get what you're saying. If someone said to me, you can never race again, I enjoy biking and running and swimming with my mates and the whole process of it. That's why I ride my bike on a Sunday, because I enjoy doing it with my mates, not because I'm training for an Ironman next year. And there's a group of us that swim together. So I just love training with other people and going out on my own, foul running and whatever. So if I could never race again, that would never stop me training. I don't train just to race. That said, it's a choice between coaching or racing. As much as I love coaching, I think I love racing more. I just love the big event thing and the camaraderie of it and the whole community. I think that I'd be really sad if I could never take part in an event again. So I'm going to be selfish and I'm going to have to say, first and foremost, I enjoy taking part in events.
Okay. Steve-o?
Yeah, I mean, it is a good question. I'm going to come down with Mark though on this one. I think, although I do love coaching, at the end of the day, it is a career or a job. One day I will retire from it. I don't ever intend to retire from training or let's not say competing, but participating.
If I could have put it better, I would have said it like that.
Well, that's good. You two are going to have plenty of time to discuss it in your little cosy tete-a-tete on your desert island, aren't you, without me?
When we're running around that island.
When you're chasing Mark to get his curly whirly.
When it's my turn to chase.
And he's trying to stop you for showing your monkey. Anyway, listen, chaps, it's been great. Thank you very much for joining us yet again.
You're welcome.
Mark, you've made it through to 4 episodes now, even though you stated that you were surprised to get invited back, although this could be the last one.
When Steve leaves, I'll tell you that it was you I wanted to spend time with on the island.
It's too late. It's too late now.
Great. Anyway.
It's been good. I hope everybody. I've had a lot of fun actually today. It's been good. I hope everybody enjoys it as much as I have. And thanks for joining us again. I'm sure we'll be back for another. Maybe we'll do a Christmas special, eh? Then we can get dressed up as Mark. You can get dressed up as a blonde Magnum.
Oh yeah.
I like the white Magnums.
Yeah. And Steve, you could. Me and you could be. We could be Christmas characters or something. We'll do a fancy... Hey, how about that one? We'll do a fancy dress one for Christmas.
Fancy dress? Yeah. Come on it.
All right. Nice one.
A Halloween one. You and Steve can just come as you are.
and you can come as a scary monster. All right. Well, that's all, folks. Thanks for listening.
Right, then. That's a wrap for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high-performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.